from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in this morning's opening hour, we discuss new research on dietary supplements and multivitamins. How much do they help keep us healthy and fit, and in what ways do they affect us that can be potentially of harm to our health? And what about their reducing the likelihood of cancer, heart disease, and stroke? An hour all about vitamins and your health after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. A new study recently published in the Journal of American Medicine, JAMA, appears to prove that taking multivitamins helps to lower cancer risk in older men. No similar evidence supports the notion that multivitamins reduce the chances of developing heart disease. And a recent consumer survey conducted by the Council for Responsible Nutrition on dietary supplements reveals that 68% of American adults take nutritional or dietary supplements, while some 52% take multivitamins. Annual vitamin supplement sales in the United States are presently in the billions of dollars. So how important are dietary supplements and multivitamins to our health, and what are the risks, if any? And in this opening hour of Forum, we want to focus on dietary supplements, vitamins and multivitamins, and your health. Joining us from Boston is J. Michael Gaziano. He's chief of the Division of Aging at Brigham and Women's and VA Hospital in Boston. And we welcome you to the program, Dr. Gaziano.
It's a pleasure to be here.
We also have with us this morning Jose Luis Mosquera. He is a medical consultant for Consumer Reports and joins us from Newark, New Jersey. And welcome, Dr. Mosquera.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Duffy McKay is also with us. Vice President of Scientific and Regulatory Affairs for the Council for Responsible Nutrition. They're a trade group that represents vitamin supplement makers and ingredient suppliers. And we'll get your name right here. It's Duffy McKay.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Thank you, Dr. McKay, for joining us. And let me begin with Dr. Gaziano. And let's just establish what this recent study proves in terms of reduction of cancer. As I understand it, Dr. Gaziano, it was largely, in fact, almost exclusively done with doctors over the age of 60 and using placebos and a double blind?
Yes, it was. It was a randomized double-blinded trial, and it was all done by mail in 15,000 physicians. And we tested a standard multivitamin. And referring back to your early comments, I want to just make a clear distinction. There's a lot of supplements out there, and a lot of trials have been done largely with single supplements at very high doses, perhaps higher than you get from a regular diet. We tested a single standard multivitamin with upwards of 30 different vitamins and minerals, and it was a randomized trial conducted over an average of 11 years, up to 14 years of treatment and follow-up.
And you discovered through this pretty convincingly that it reduces the likelihood of cancer by what, somewhere between 6 and 8%?
So we saw an 8% reduction in total cancer, and that was statistically significant. Moreover, we saw a reduction in about 12%, also significant if we excluded the prostate cancers. These doctors did a lot of prostate cancer screening and detected a lot of very early prostate cancers. So we looked at the total cancers, and then total cancer mortality went in the same direction, again, 12%. Not quite statistically significant, but it was certainly suggestive that even for cancer mortality that there was a benefit.
This is a pretty exclusive group, though. I mean, what does it tell us, for example, about cancer in women or in, for that matter, younger males and females, especially in light of the fact that I suppose with a good diet and exercise and not smoking, you can maybe do as well in reducing these numbers, maybe better.
Maybe better, particularly for smoking, and certainly the suggestion for a varied diet, which is almost what perhaps this tried to mimic, that varied diet and exercise have been observationally shown to lower the risk of cancer, and they effect sizes, the magnitude of benefit you get seems to be bigger, but remember, those are observational studies. Ours is a trial. Now, does it apply to younger people or women, we can't say with certainty, and that's often the case after a large trial. However, most of the things that prevent cancer in men do, or cause cancer in men, like smoking or stopping, do so in women and across the age spectrum.
There is perhaps a good deal of mythology about the reduction of cardiac risk with multivitamins. There's really nothing to show that, is there?
That's correct. And our study looked at both the major cardiovascular events as a lumped them all into one outcome, and then we looked at individual ones that made up that endpoint definition, including myocardial infarction, stroke, and death from cardiovascular causes, and then we saw no reduction in risk.
J. Michael Gaziano, again, is Chief of Division of Aging at Brigham and Women's VA Boston Hospital, and Duffy Mackay is Vice President of Scientific and Regulatory Affairs for the Council for Responsible Nutrition. What reasons, from your perspective, Dr. Mackay, are there to take vitamins, especially multivitamins? I know that they can fill nutrition gaps, but aside from that?
Well, we have several clearly proven benefits of the multivitamin in subpopulations, things like folic acid for pregnant women, iodine for pregnancy and breastfeeding, calcium for strong bones, vitamin D to prevent the risk of falls. The list goes on and on. So, you know, getting the recommended amount of these nutrients is critical for maintaining health.
There's also a fear among many people, and I wonder if maybe you could address this, that, well, they'll be taking vitamins in lieu of tending to their health. In other words, doing things that we alluded to earlier when I was talking with Dr. Gaziano, I mean, paying attention to your diet and your exercise and not smoking.
Right. This is an ongoing myth within the literature. You see people concerned about, you know, the use of dietary supplements in place of other healthy habits. But in fact, if you look at the data that's available, specifically data from the government, the NHANES data, it shows that vitamin users do practice other healthy behaviors. They're more likely to exercise, visit their doctor, get screening prevention, eat a healthy diet, have a lower BMI, et cetera. And that's what the data shows.
And is it your judgment that there should be more regulation, or there's not enough regulation where vitamins are concerned?
Vitamins are very adequately regulated by the FDA. We have strong manufacturing standards. We have adverse event reporting amongst a slew of other labeling requirements. So, you know, we are very adequately regulated at the current time.
I'm not sure that we're in agreement on this with you, Dr. Mascara, are we?
Well, not really. The FDA does have some substantial regulations, particularly when it comes to iron content in vitamins and supplements, but I think the audience has to understand several things here, that supplements and vitamins are certainly not risk-free. They're just because they're considered sometimes natural, that doesn't mean they're safe nor natural. Many supplements we have found are even contain prescription drugs. This is not the multivitamins, of course, but there have been supplements out there reported with prescription drugs, especially for diets, the same drug that's in Meridia, subutryptamine. Cialis, Viagra has been found in some of these supplements. But getting back to the vitamins that you had mentioned, certainly these are not risk-free. People have to remember that you can actually overdose on vitamins as well, particularly certain vitamins that are considered what are called fat-soluble vitamins. These are vitamins A, D, E, and K. So labeling is a very important issue, and I think should get the consumer needs to have better labeling and risks because these vitamins simply are not risk-free. Over the last 5 years, there's been 6,300 reports of serious adverse effects. There's been about, I think, reported 115 deaths in that time period with 10,300 serious outcomes. So certainly, this doesn't compare, of course, with prescription medication by any standard, but nonetheless, I think the public feels that vitamins are totally safe, and they're not. They have to consider if they're taking other medications. They have to consider the interactions between vitamins and medications. Some may provide further blood thinning. Some may, as the doctor said, some vitamins are useful in other states. Vegetarians, people, as you mentioned, in pregnancy with folate and iodine and breastfeeding, people with liver disease and vegetarians with B-complex needs, et cetera. But I think the main message from a consumer standpoint is that they are not risk-free, and the consumer and the FDA has to do a better job of notifying the consumer of this.
And it's your contention also that there is, false advertising and scamming going on.
Well, there's no question. That is, the literature is filled with claims, especially when it comes to vitamins and supplements that supposedly provide either sexual enhancement or weight loss. Consumers have to be very wary of these claims and also side effects. And as I mentioned, many of these supplements may be adulterated or contaminated in some cases with heavy metals, and there's studies that demonstrate this. So it really is a consumer beware issue. On the multivitamins, the ones that were studied, these were studied in physicians over the age of 50, a fairly health-conscious group to begin with. But it doesn't say anything on how vitamins, people view vitamins as a preventative, sort of an integrative plan of their health, and many start much younger. Many start in their teens, in their 20s and 30s. I think more studies are needed in this group to see outcomes later on in life. And the 50-plus, there's so many back factors in one's age before 50 in terms of lifestyle and risk factors that these studies that say cancer, there's a cancer reduction, I'd like to see them duplicated in other studies in the future.
Well, you also feel, I think, that maybe too many people are taking vitamins. It comes down, in your judgment, to maybe less than 10% who ought to be taking or really need them.
That's correct. And I've been practicing for close to 30 years, and most people, unless they're in that group of that pregnancy group, and or they're on a less than 1,200 calorie diet, or they have malabsorption. I mean, certainly there's people who should take supplements and vitamins in those categories determined by physicians or health professionals. But the vast majority are just taking it with no specific reason. And as we were discussing earlier, many of them take it in lieu of a healthy lifestyle, what we call an integrative medicine, an approach of a healthy lifestyle, including mind, body, and spirit. It's all about nutrition. It's interesting. There was a study, for example, a Swedish study where women, it was published in 2010, where 35,000 women were studied, ages 49 to 83, and they found that they actually had an increased risk of breast cancer in their study. It was a prospective study; it wasn't what we call a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study. But there were also studies where in their diet, if you have a balanced diet with calcium supplements, et cetera, that there was no increased risk when they compared it to a nutritional study. So, I think that vitamins should never be a substitute for a healthy nutritional lifestyle.
I ought to mention, too, I'm no physician, but both vitamin C and E can actually lower effectiveness of some types of chemotherapy, and they're in megadoses of A, D, E, and K can cause problems as well. But let me go back to Duffy Mackay, because I'm sure you have some, concerns about what we've just heard from Dr. Mascara.
Well, absolutely. With regard to labeling, vitamins are labeled. They have the percent daily value on the label. We encourage people to follow label instructions to get the right amounts of vitamins for their needs, which are clearly dictated on the label. We also encourage people to engage with their healthcare provider about their diet and their dietary lifestyles. With regard to the number of people who may need dietary supplements, if you take a look at it, something like the 2010 Dietary Guidelines for Americans, clearly showing that there are several shortfall nutrients in the general population, things like calcium and vitamin D, potassium, dietary fiber, omega-3 fatty acids, and this is the majority of Americans, so not quite sure where the 10% may need vitamins comes from. I've also had experience in practice where I discuss diet with people, and I find that it's rare that someone is eating to the dietary guidelines, getting all the nutrients they need from food. So, in fact, I strongly disagree that vitamins play a key role in a healthy lifestyle, and they're not instead of other lifestyle habits. If someone chooses to forego, quitting smoking or exercising and decide to take a supplement instead, they have their priorities clearly misplaced. But it's part of, and in fact, as I stated before, that's what the data shows. People who take vitamins practice other healthy habits. They exercise. They eat well. It's a whole package of wellness.
Let me have you weigh in here, J. Michael Gaziano.
So I think there are two groups of people that take vitamins, and you know, one group is the group that has developed some illness, and then they begin searching for alternative therapy. That's a very small group, but I agree that by and large, my patients who take their multivitamins, and this has been shown in our studies as well, they tend to be at the healthier end of the spectrum. Now, with that said, it's our job as physicians or, you know, healthcare providers and even people who market these products to keep the patient's perceptions in line with the realities. And we do that in medicine all the time. If I've got a patient who thinks they're getting some benefit out of, you know, any supplement, and they're doing that instead of stopping smoking, then it's my job to recalibrate. And I think that's done really all the time. I think that we needed a large-scale study of a simple standard multivitamin that has never been done before, and now we have some evidence that we can have that kind of discussion with our participants.
But I think it's safe to say, isn't it, that we need more studies, as Dr. Mascaro suggested, and more trials, particularly you know, long-term effects of multivitamins?
I think that's right. And, you know, the nice thing is that they are relatively safe. I mean, by comparison, you can abuse anything. I mean, you can abuse water. There are people that die of water intoxication. But these are relatively safe substances was one of the reasons that we looked at them. I agree, more trials would be ideal, but you have to be patient. And we started this trial 17 years ago. It took us 2 years to get it funded. It took us 14 years of treatment and follow-up, you know, recruited the patients over a five or six-year period. The participants happened to be physicians. And then it took us 1 year to close it out. And here we are 17 years later with a good answer on two of our outcomes, cardiovascular disease without material benefit, a modest benefit demonstrated, and I'm sure people will debate, you know, these findings for years to come because it'll be a while before we get another study of the like. And we will be giving more data from our cohort. We hope to follow up these individuals longer to see if there's a longer-term effect, what we call a latent effect for cancer. And then we're going to be reporting later this year information on eye disease and then cognitive function in this group of physicians.
Well, there are I had alluded before to the fact that no studies have corroborated the notion that vitamins are preventive where heart disease is concerned, and certainly vitamins don't cure much that we're talking about here. But there have been other studies. For example, fish oil doesn't work for irregular heartbeat, for atrial fibrillation, should be noted, because I think, again, a lot of people feel that it is of help. But let me go back to Jose Luis Mascara and talk some more about regulation with you, Dr. Mascara. From your perspective, I mean, a third of adults are taking dietary supplements, and there's really no government agency looking at them, is there?
No, absolutely not. They're regulated much like a food, following called the Deshaies Act of 1994, where the FDA does not really get involved. They do get involved in when there's major events like the ephedra related medical conditions and deaths that occurred back in the 90s, and they banned ephedra from the market. But for the most part, looking at this whole thing about labeling and regulation, it just almost non-existent. It's sort of like the Wild West out there with these claims. At Consumer Reports, we went shopping and looked at about 233 products purchased online in the New York City area. And although some of them contain warnings for pregnancy or nursing, very few, I think less than 40%, warned people about taking the supplement if they had a medical condition or if they were taking any other medication to speak to their doctor first. They very rarely cited problems with bleeding disorders, all in very small percentages. And this is an area that really has to be better regulated. Yes, as the doctor said, you can report this, but you know, many of these reports never get to the proper through the proper channels. It's just an area that I think needs stricter regulation. And also, patients need to speak with experts in this area, say, integrative medicine, doctors who are familiar with the risks and benefits of supplements and who have studied them, and particularly doctors with particular training in integrative medicine where they've looked at the evidence-based complementary and alternative therapies that are out there with these supplements.
Let me bring it back to you, Duffy Mackay. Again, the concerns that we're hearing from Dr. Mascara?
Well, I just want to correct the record, Michael. You mentioned no government agencies got oversight. In fact, that's incorrect. The Food and Drug Administration has oversight of dietary supplement labels.
Let me actually correct what I said. I wasn't talking about FDA here. I was talking about specific government agencies that are set up sort of like a silo in terms of regulating and doing the job that we're sort of talking about here. But please, go ahead.
Sorry. Oh, yeah. In fact, there is the... there's a office within the FDA that's specifically dedicated to dietary supplements. They train their inspectors how to inspect a facility for good manufacturing practices. Then there's the list goes on as far as other things that they implement. And then on the flip side of that, we have the Federal Trade Commission that's very active in the regulation of dietary supplement claims. As you know, all claims made for dietary supplements by law should be truthful and not misleading and substantiated by credible scientific evidence.
Right.
Yes, there are bad actors out there, but I think it's fair to say there are bad actors in every industry. And the responsible industry does everything it can to reduce the reach of these bad actors. And a lot of what Dr. Mascara is referring to is these outliers and the behaviors of these outliers.
Right.
Products with drugs in them are illegal. In the past year, several makers of these products have gone to jail, or they've had consent decrees put on them by the FDA. So, in fact, I think the picture that Dr. Mascara is painting is a little imbalanced. The flip side of that picture is a very responsible industry making products with the purity and potency, lack of contaminants, like the product that was used in this study, very high quality, providing the nutrition that people are seeking.
Well,
what's on the label is in the bottle.
Can I?
Jose Luis Mascara.
Thank you. Now, I agree with what the doctor just mentioned. The Federal Trade Commission over the past decade has monitored and has brought over 100 legal challenges to certain supplements and the other ones you mentioned as well, the National Institutes of Health Office of Dietary Supplements, et cetera. But let me point out that only less than one-fourth of all the supplements out there are USP verified. The USP is called the U.S. Pharmacopeia, and it is at least what the doctor was saying about the safety of the dosage and purity of what you're buying. This is a voluntary submission by the producers of supplements that they can do. And only one quarter of – now, remember, there's over 50,000 products out there on the shelves. Less than 25% of them, approximately, are USP verified, which at least gives the consumer some certainty that this is a – the dosage and the safety and the purity of what they're buying is so. So it leaves the majority of these supplements out there really not being verified. In fact, many of them can be bought over the internet. They can come from other countries without any standards of both safety and purity and dosaging. So, this is a real issue that needs higher regulation.
All right, I'm coming up on a hard break, and I believe Duffy Mackay may want to respond to that. But I also want to get our listeners involved in this discussion. We're not only talking about regulation and concern about regulation, we're talking about a new study that actually shows, and more studies need to be done, reduction with respect to risk of cancer by taking multivitamins. You may want to join us with questions or comments. We're really talking on kind of a large canvas here about what vitamins can do, what they can't do, and you're welcome to join the program. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Do vitamins make you healthier? A couple of recent studies disagree on the answer to that. One says vitamins help prevent cancer, and a new one out Monday says they do not help prevent heart attacks or strokes in men. And we're discussing whether vitamins are actually crucial to good health, asking if supplement-happy Americans are going too far, and really what ought to be done, perhaps more or is it all adequate with respect to the whole question of regulation? We have with us Dr. Jose Luis Mosquera, who is medical consultant for Consumer Reports, Dr. J. Michael Gaziano, chief of the Division of Aging at Brigham and Women's and Veterans Administration Healthcare System in Boston. He's also principal investigator for a large-scale trial of vitamins in the prevention of chronic disease, and Dr. Duffy Mackay, who's vice president and scientific and regulatory affairs for the Council for Responsible Nutrition, a trade group that represents vitamin supplement makers and ingredient suppliers, and he's with us from Las Vegas, and you can be with us as well. In fact, we welcome your calls, toll-free number 866-733-6786. If you have questions or comments, you can also email them to us, forum@kqed.org, or put them on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment. Other ways to communicate with us, go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And we're going to go to your calls and emails in just a moment here. I want to go back, though, to Duffy Mackay. And Dr. Mackay, you want to respond to what Dr. Mosquera just said, please?
Yeah, he had mentioned about the USP seal, which is a voluntary third-party seal that verifies potency and purity of vitamins. And I just wanted to mention that there are other third-party seals. This is a for-profit situation, USP. You pay them, and they will evaluate and test your product so that you can have that seal. It's a very legitimate way to go. All companies don't choose to do that. There are other seals, NSF seal, HSF seal. There's seals that prove that it's been, you know, free of banned substances. So the fact that less than 25% use the USP seal is sort of irrelevant. By law, all vitamins need to meet their label claims. What's in the bottle's got to be on the label. That's what responsible companies do.
Well, for example, what comes swiftly to my mind here is all of the hype and inflated notions of what vitamin E could do. But when the research came out, things changed pretty radically, didn't they?
In the area of vitamin E, you know, we can go into some of the details if you choose, but like the negative vitamin E trials, you know, there's been some discussions about the research design and various elements if you drill down deep, but in fact, when you look at vitamin E and just getting the recommended amounts, we find that over 90% of Americans are not consuming the recommended amounts of vitamin E from food alone. Therefore, these amounts have been established by the Institute of Medicine just to maintain health, and so a vitamin supplement serves its role at filling that nutrition gaps. It doesn't promise to cure every disease known to man, but it's an important component of a healthy lifestyle, which includes eating right, exercising, and responsible use of supplements.
Okay, we're going to go to your calls, and let's do that forthwith. In fact, let's begin with a caller from Michigan. Greg, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear me okay?
Can hear you fine.
My name is Greg. I work in the pharmaceutical industry, and I guess my question when I think of these natural supplements is anything in the pharmaceutical industry, before it comes to market, is rigorously tested, has it proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that it's both safe and effective. I guess my question is, how can they get away with even bringing this to market in the first place? And I don't know if this has been covered on the show. And how can they always hide behind the things that it's all natural? I guess that's a pet peeve of mine, too, because dirt is all natural. If you put it in a capsule and said, hey, this is a grape for such and such, and make it up, you have a time where you could actually bring that to market and put that out there. What's in the capsule is dirt, as recommended, you know, by the thing. Yep, what's in the capsule is like that. I claim it does this. How is that even allowed to go on? And thank you. I'll listen off the air.
All right. We thank you for the call, Dr. Mosquera.
Yeah, the answer is it's marketing. It's all about marketing. And there's we get back to the very little regulation compared to prescription drugs, and they are viewed as really food supplements, as ingredients, food ingredients. And many of these are not, as the caller was saying, natural. I mean, natural could mean a lot of things. Of course, you can have funguses that are poisonous. They're natural. It gets back to the whole regulation, and we need to have legislation that really has oversight to protect patients and consumers. There's clearly serious adverse effects when it comes to supplements. Not so much the multivitamins. I agree with the doctor who was mentioning that they are labeled, and they're labeled. The multivitamins, the bigger makers are, do a good job labeling, but not enough with warnings as well. But it's all marketing and lack of regulation.
If I could jump in right,
Duffy
here,
Mackay.
The multivitamins.
It's Dr. J. Michael Gaziano. Right?
Yeah, so multivitamins, you know, I think that we do need to make a distinction. Multivitamins have been brought to market and tested for a reason different than we're discussing, and it's to prevent deficiency. And they have been tested, and we understand that's how we get at what recommended daily allowances are, and where we arrive at through a long processes of looking at what literature is available and what's the recommended daily allowance. Now, the if you got a multivitamin, it can prevent deficiency, and it's available. The issue is that some people can take it for perceived other benefits, and that's what we were trying to address. Now, and that's perhaps there is marketing for some of these other benefits, and I think that's a separate issue. But they have an important primary function.
I agree fully with Dr. Bucarezzi on the same. By the way, I don't want to it about vitamins and their purpose, especially for those nutritious deficiencies that are out there. And I think they certainly are very valuable tool. I certainly agree with that aspect.
Well, there are a lot of things that really require more education. I think they have nothing to do with marketing, just facts. I mean, from what I've been reading, vitamin K can affect bleeding and interfere with some heart drugs. You've got supplements that, as Dr. Mascara said, maybe spike with prescription drugs or other sorts of toxicity. Yeah. And there are more rashes among vitamin users, I discovered, to my surprise. Not to mention the fact that when you have, say, somebody who is a former smoker, they're told to avoid multivitamins with lots of beta carotenes or vitamin A because essentially a couple studies link those to greater risks of lung cancer. So there's lots of stuff out there that people just don't know about.
Michael, do you mind if I jump back
Please.
To the caller's question?
Yeah.
I just wanted to quickly say that the scenario that the caller presented about putting dirt in a capsule, that is not legal. He was asking the question, why is that legal? It's, in fact, totally not legal. If you have a new product that you want, a new ingredient like dirt that's never been on the market before, you actually have to provide the FDA with a pre-market safety dossier before you can go to market.
Well, that was a maybe hyperbolic example, but I think he was also trying to emphasize that you can put natural on lots of things, and what makes something natural?
You can only put natural on if it's natural. We know that many synthetic vitamins are out there. There's synthetic vitamin E, there's synthetic vitamin K, and on these products you could not put natural on there. That would be, in fact, false advertising. But now if you're selling a fish oil where the oil is derived from the fish, that is all natural. So I think, unfortunately, the caller was making the mistake. You have hundreds of different dietary ingredients, things that come from food, vitamins, minerals. We have herbs. We have echinacea. We have ginger. We have ginseng. Really hard to lump all of these things together. It's like if I was to say all drugs are the same. Let's talk about, are drugs safe? Well, in fact, some drugs are truly really safe, and other drugs may be less safe. And I think there's many examples in history that show us that while drugs are approved by the FDA and it is a very rigorous process, we make mistakes.
Well, I have a listener here, actually, and I think we're right on point, who sends the following email. I'd like maybe to get your response, Duffy McKay. He says, what about the distinction between herbal supplements and multivitamin preparations? Herbals have many disadvantages, lack of data, significant side effects, complex mixtures with compounds, the problem of drug interactions, and frequent lack of quality control.
So this is a very astute observation. Botanical supplements are different than vitamins and minerals. Botanical supplements have been used for hundreds of years as part of staying healthy. They have a much longer track record than many of the tools we currently use when people are sick. That doesn't mean they're all safe. These are plants. They have compounds in them. And that's why the regulatory framework for dietary supplements, when Congress enacted DSHEA in 1994, they very specifically, through hours and hours of meetings with stakeholders, tried to balance consumer access with safety. If we went with the drug model and we had to do pre-market approval, our supplements would have to go through multi-million dollar pre-market processes, and these were things that were already on the market, safely used by Americans since the 1900s, and both Congress, consumers, and stakeholders felt it was an adequate framework to balance consumer access with consumer safety.
All right. I want to bring more of our callers on. Sandy, some testimony about vitamin C helping your mother?
My stepmother was, Michael.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, first of all, I just wanted to say I'm glad to see Linus Pauling, former Nobel Prize winner in another area, finally vindicated around vitamin C and cancer. He's written books on that that can be found. But in the late 80s, my stepmother was diagnosed with in addition to stomach cancer, which was taken out, they found she had cancer in her lymph system. She was 81 at the time and given 6 months to live by both Alta Bates and Stanford. And my PhD chemist father stepped in, knowing Linus Pauling's data, with 10 grams of vitamin C in the form of calcium ascorbate, as well as a good multiple vitamin mineral supplement, and I think a couple of other things like vitamin E. And she went on to live another 13 years until she was 94, and continuing to smoke, I might add, which I don't think is recommended. But
well, we're pleased to hear that she got better and lived all those years, but I wonder about the link to vitamin C, especially in light of your phrasing it that Linus Pauling was vindicated. I remember, although Michael Gazzano, let me go to you on this, because there was a lot of talk about vitamin C around Linus Pauling, whom, as the caller suggested, got a Nobel Prize in physics, and multi-doses of vitamin C, I think really wildly exaggerated.
Yeah, I would say so. We did a study in the Physician's Health Study and also reported it in JAMA about 4 years ago, this same group of physicians. They've been together for about 30 years, and we've done four major trials all by mail, and we did a vitamin C trial, and we treated the same 15,000 physician group with a high dose of vitamin C and a placebo, and we saw no benefit in terms of heart disease, cancer, cognitive function, or
maybe even the common cold. A lot of people think that vitamin C will cure the common cold. I think zinc might be better.
Yeah, well, then the data is not the trial data is not particularly supportive on that front either.
Well, let me thank the caller. We'll go on to more of your calls in a moment, but just a plain question here for you, Dr. J. Michael Gazzano. Alex asks, do the potential risks from vitamins outweigh the potential benefits for a basically healthy 24-year-old male? I've lived hard, lots of drinking and smoking. I'm trying to whip myself into shape for the long haul. Of course, the most important things are diet, not smoking, exercise, etc. I understand that. More studies are needed. But right now, should I be taking a daily multivitamin or not?
So we did not see any major risk. It was another thing that we looked at, and we have not reported out all of our results. As I mentioned, we are going to report the results of eye disease and cognitive function. But looking at a broad collection of other potential consequences, we saw no major alarm. Now, when we're talking about prevention, and I'm a preventive cardiologist, you know, we think about lifetime risk, and he's doing the right thing as a 24-year-old. He should eat a varied diet. Over the long haul, it's my strong suspicion that eating a good diet, exercising, not smoking, maintaining a good weight, keeping track of your blood pressure, keeping track of your cholesterol, and then doing the cancer screening that is recommended is going to be the thing that's going to lower his risk the most. Now, at what point should one take a multivitamin? I'm going to circle back to my conclusion is that the main reason to take a multivitamin is to prevent deficiency. And even healthy individuals, elderly people, middle-aged adults, don't always eat a varied enough diet to make sure that they do get the recommended amounts. That's the primary reason. What we've discovered is that if you're taking it because you think it's going to prevent heart disease, you're better off doing some of those other things. However, there does appear to be a modest benefit in terms of cancer, but I still think that the main reason to consider a multivitamin is to consider the nutritional status.
Well, as long as we're talking about risks, and you're a cardiologist, what about regular users of calcium supplements? Isn't there an increased risk of heart disease?
So there's a data in both directions, and I wouldn't say it's definitive. And there are trial data, calcium with vitamin D, that did not suggest a strong benefit. The limited data will be supplemented by a couple of very large scale trials, one of which is being done by our group, and that's really going to be what we need. The vast majority of the data on calcium, vitamin D, and then some of the other ones we've talked about, vitamin E, vitamin C, that suggested harm or benefit was largely observational data. And while that's helpful in pointing us in directions, it sometimes is a little misleading because of the differences in individuals who choose to take these things at high doses compared to others who choose not to.
All right. Now, let me go to some more of your calls. We'll go to Gary next. Gary, thanks for waiting. Join us on Forum. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I wanted to relate a quick story and then make a quick comment. I was prescribed Prozac, and I've been taking it for a couple of years. No detrimental impacts. I decided to get an herbal vitamin liquid supplement, and I started taking that. About a week later, I had a very, very severe reaction, and in which I became unconscious, and 911 had to be called. So I got through that. I was hospitalized for a week. They didn't know what was going on. I was incoherent. So the next month, my psychiatrist prescribed a different antidepressant, and lo and behold, the same thing happened. I had this terrific allergic reaction, and we, determined that it was the herbal supplement. There was no warning label on the supplement. I should have known better, but I went to the hospital twice, and it was not fun. So my point is, these supplements should be labeled in some way saying, if you're taking a medication, check with your doctor. The second point I wanted to make, just a comment.
Well, wait, let's take your first point, if I may, and go to Dr. Mackay on that. What about warning labels with respect to other medications, or for that matter, as the caller suggests, allergies, Dr. Mackay?
Well, many products that have clear and strong allergic potential, things that have like herbs that are related to ragweed and things like that, will in fact be labeled. Then as far as prescription medications, I think there's some individual responsibility. If you're on a prescription medication, that prescription medication probably has a long list of things, if you read the fine print, that you're not supposed to do with it, or other drugs or other things that you shouldn't do with it. So in a lot of ways, the warning comes on your prescription. And once you start taking a prescription, you should understand, before I add other things to my body that have a physiological impact, like herbs, like other drugs, I need to check with my healthcare practitioner to make sure that these kind of events won't occur. Unfortunately, these types of things do, while rare, they do occur, and that's why the post-marketing surveillance system is in place. Ideally, this event should be reported to the FDA, where they can accumulate this evidence, and if they feel there's a need, can require a warning label or withdraw a certain ingredient. So that's the current system to monitor and address these kind of events.
Well, and you had another comment, Gary, that you wanted to make? Well, Gary seems to be gone. But a listener writes, let me follow up this with Duffy Mackay with something else. A listener says, daily recommended values for certain vitamins are a joke, and any doctor advising their patients to take not more than the current recommended daily value of vitamin D3 is most likely doing them a big disservice. We used to be outside all day without sunscreen, producing plenty of vitamin D, but these days a large portion of people are chronically vitamin D deficient. There is similar research regarding vitamin B12. And another listener says, I wonder what Dr. Mackay just said, doctors need to confront smokers who would rather take a vitamin than quit, would say about doctors who fail to address dietary issues and simply prescribe cholesterol-lowering drugs. I had to slow down my doctor, who was reaching for his pad, and explain that I would rather change my diet than go on a drug. These are kind of unrelated points, but I think you get the responses here. And what do you say, Dr. Mackay?
Well, I think that it's a good point. I mean, some doctors, because of the environment they're in, they do sort of forget that the first line of defense for lifestyle-related diseases is encourage the patient to change their lifestyle. Early heart disease, cholesterol's creeping up, first line of therapy, everyone who goes to medical school is taught the same thing, change diet, get exercising. If a doctor's reaching for the prescription pad, they're forgetting the training they got in medical school. The first point, I actually forgot what the first point was.
First point had to do with, again, what the expectations are with certain vitamins and the labeling and the way the doctors advise.
The
D3 specifically.
Yeah, I think the daily values are very conservative. You have to remember it's a public health number. It's a number that's derived to try to cover the entire population. There are definitely going to be individuals within the population for individual dietary choices or lifestyle choices will require higher amounts. I think the notion that mega-dosing more is better is a little bit of a dangerous notion. We need to be careful with assuming, and I think Dr. Mascara would not disagree with this. We can't assume because there are essential nutrients and some is good that more is always better, and that's why we have upper limits for dietary intake levels. We have guidelines that say, hey, look, there's really no evidence that going beyond these high levels is going to do you any more benefit. And I think the case with vitamin D is a really unique situation because vitamin D, it's a hormone. It's created from the sun. All of the listeners' points are accurate. Our lifestyles have changed. And so likely the recommended amounts for vitamin D, you know, you could probably do better with 1,000 to 2,000 IUs as opposed to what's recommended. But we have an upper limit of 4,000 to 10,000 IUs, and I think that's also a number to respect for chronic.
I know Dr. Mascara wants in here, but I just want to read a sentence from our Facebook page. Sandy, one of our listeners, writes, I don't bother taking vitamins except for D3 because I get the winter blues, and it seems to help me. Dr. Mascara?
Yeah, I certainly vitamin D, and if you live above the latitudes of Atlanta in the United States, you're going to be relatively deficient, and there's some studies that suggest that it can be beneficial. It seems to be a cofactor in a lot of medical conditions, but getting back to some of the points that were made that you're making, there is consistency amongst the warning labels in supplements, and unlike what Dr. Graziano was saying, where vitamins do have a standardization, there is really a lack of standardized doses in when you're talking about supplements in the supplement industry. In fact, some companies do provide a standardization. And when you speak to experts in this area, I practice integrative medicine, and I probably have used more supplements and botanicals than most doctors out there. You look for what are called standardized doses, and you have to be familiar with a standardized dose, say, of what St. John's Wort or any of the common supplements, echinacea, et cetera, and that have been studied. These standardized doses have been studied in trials. The problem is the consumer, the patient out there, is bewildered when they walk into a vitamin shop because it's not at all clear what is a standardized dose. Whereas with vitamins, as Dr. Graziano was saying, certainly it's clear that you know there's a multivitamin has these recommended daily allowances, minimal daily requirements, et cetera, that are clear to the consumer.
Well, I want to go to more of your calls, and let's go to you. Susan, join us. Hi.
Oh, hi. I have atrial fibrillation occasionally, and there's nothing wrong with my heart. They did the, you know, they x-rayed me and did the, whatever they do, cardiogram and all that kind of stuff. And I don't have any particular, you know, there's no particular reason. They call it, I guess it's paroxysmal atrial fibrillation. And my cardiologist just told me to take aspirin, a small dose every day. And they actually stopped it with calcium blockers. It's a drug called, it's unpronounceable, diatazem or something.
Diltiazem.
Yeah, okay, that sounds good.
Cartizem.
Yeah, but anyway, what confused me, what I don't understand is I was told to stop taking vitamin E. I wasn't taking a lot. I was only taking somewhere between 200 to 400 international units a day. And so I'm just wondering, I don't really understand. I know there's been a study, but I don't really understand what the problem is. And I'm wondering about the study and if what the quality of the vitamin E was, if it was synthetic or,
Well, let's see if we can get a response for you. Dr. Mascara, you were going to respond?
Sure, yeah. Vitamin E, what they were probably alluding to the caller is the increased risk of bleeding with people taking vitamin D in excess, and usually that excess is over 200 international units. Vitamin D studies have been here and there. There was a study a few years ago which people taking over 400, it actually increased their risk of certain cardiac events, et cetera. I think that that was vitamin E. There's various types of vitamin E called tocopherols and mixed tocopherols, and a lot of the studies don't address that. But clearly, vitamin D can cause can contribute to bleeding. And this caller with paroxysmal atrial fibrillation, she should speak to her doctor because there are many other underlying causes, from thyroid problems to other issues, maybe other medications that she's been taking. She should clearly look at this. And for some, taking a daily aspirin will prevent the whole risk with atrial fibrillation is the risk of stroke in a percentage of the population. And it's a very common arrhythmia. And she should just keep pursuing an adequate diagnosis and treatment of this.
And we wish you good luck, Susan, and thank you for the call. I want to go to some of your emails here. Lots of emails coming in and website postings. And, of course, you can continue to post on our website even after the program's over, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or go to our Facebook page. Lou Anne Brizendine, physician over at UCSF, writes us, "This is a very important show. In 1994, I started doing a study on a hormone called DHEA, which is a controlled substance in other countries outside the USA. In the US, it is considered a nutritional supplement. It is dangerous to take these hormones over the counter. Many of us doctors are concerned about this industry not being controlled by the FDA. It is now run by the lobby for these companies. The public is not aware of this serious problem and potential risk to their health." And Mike writes, "Vitamins, food supplements, human growth hormones. This is a huge industry built on lies, hustle, snakes, oil. Okay, there might be some good stuff. I believe consumers are not being well served by our regulatory processes." And more listener responses. I just want to get on the record here. Kristen says, "It's oversimplified to suggest that it not be legal to advertise anything that makes health claims. Go back to when it was not legal to advertise drugs and add health supplements and vitamins to that list. Consumers will need to do their own research and or listen to their doctors and health advocates' advice. I object to the micromanaging of every little thing we may want to do for our own health. Consumer beware." Another listener writes, "As a boomer, I and my friends are watching the information about what we need in our age group and older. Our doctors are telling us, and the literature as well, that absorption decreases with age. Our doctors are testing us for vitamin D and B12 levels, just as examples, and finding our levels low, then prescribing extra supplements." Well, we could go on here, but we are out of time. I want to thank our guest, Dr. J. Michael Gaziano from the Brigham and Women's and Veterans Administration Healthcare System in Boston, and Dr. Duffy Mackay from the Council for Responsible Nutrition, and Dr. Jose Luis Mosquera, who is with Consumer Reports. And thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. Another hour ahead, we're going to talk about the late author David Foster Wallace with his biographer in the hour ahead. Stay tuned for that. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.